I believe there's a very powerful universal language to movement and dance. We sometimes don't even realize it, but there's even a psychological component of how certain movements communicate to us and they communicate across languages.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hello, my name is Rachel Linsky. I'm a Boston-based contemporary dance artist. For the past 3 years, I've been directing and choreographing an ongoing project series, Sahor, that seeks to preserve the words of World War II Holocaust survivors through dance. Welcome to Sylvia and me.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining me here today. And as you said, you're a dancer through choreography and dance. You have created a series called Zachor, which means remembrance, or you shall remember. And it's about the Holocaust and World War II survivors. How did you even get started? Why? I mean, I could find 5 million reasons why we need to remember, but why was it important to you to do this and really focus on the Holocaust and the survivors?
Yeah, so Zahor built gradually over time, and there's a whole timeline of how it developed, and starting from just one piece to an ongoing series of multiple pieces that I do plan to continue to work on for, you know, as long as I can and as long as people are willing to listen and reflect with me and work with me on this. But Zahor started, I was in college at Elon University in North Carolina. And before going to college, so growing up, I grew up in very, you could call it like a Jewish bubble in Boston. I went to Solomon Schechter Day School of Greater Boston, went to Camp Yavna. I have a big Jewish family here. We all live very close. My father's family came from Austria during World War II. We've always been fascinated in learning as much of their stories as we can. And in school, the importance of Holocaust education, it was not only deeply ingrained in us, but the frequency of which we talked about it was huge. And I also am part of a very unique generation, as I've come to learn in doing this work, that my parents' generation, for example, and folks older than them as well, they grew up, you know, their parents or their aunts and uncles and their neighbors are Holocaust survivors. I've had people reach out after shows, you know, like they had tattoos on their arms, but no one ever talked about it.
That's the thing. No one ever talked about it. You had extremes. You had people who did, very few. Most did not.
Yeah. And for me, however, growing up, we got to hear from living Holocaust survivors frequently, at least once a year in school and in other settings, like we would get to hear firsthand accounts, and the importance of it was stressed. And that felt very, I suppose, common in my upbringing. But from doing this work, I've come to learn generation above me didn't have that experience. And now the generation below me won't have that experience. Time is fleeting, and we only have so many years left to hear firsthand accounts. So the responsibility, not just that general human responsibility that we all have to keep the stories alive, but being in that unique generation that I am, that we've had the most opportunity to hear these accounts firsthand, and to have people willing to share their stories with us in hopes that we will take them on, has certainly been very driving and impactful in this time. But I went to college in North Carolina, and kind of leaving that Jewish bubble was so striking from being you know, part of a community where you don't necessarily even feel, you know, you don't feel like you're a minority because it's a whole Jewish community, to then go to a school where some of my friends, I was the first Jewish person they had ever met, was very, very striking. And, you know, luckily I had grown up in that community that I was very confident in my identity and my Jewish identity, that I was able to keep that. And even as for those 4 years, as my Judaism became a very personal thing, and I tried to teach my friends all these different practices and cultures and things and symbols that held significance to me, it was definitely a switch. And I had gone on a Jewish hiking trip probably my sophomore year of college and remember being asked, like, did you learn about the Holocaust in school? I was like, of course. And then as we talked more about it, I realized that only at like Schechter and Yavna and in these Jewish situations had I went to a public high school in a very Jewish town nonetheless, but I was like, no, we actually did not study it in high school. And my friends in college who knew so little about Judaism to begin with, it was such a foreign thing to some of them, they hadn't had that experience either, where it was stressed. So it's in the Jewish community, in that community, we study it a lot. We hold this history and we hold the importance of keeping it alive very closely. But if we all remain in our own community bubbles, studying only our own histories, how could we ever work towards that goal of never again to be able to stand up for one another if we're within our own community, studying our own histories and holding them close? So from that experience in college, kind of realizing that was a big push for me to create this project and create this opportunity, because I believe that this history can be a strong base, and we can use the lessons that survivors have for us and apply them to a lot of current socio-political issues. And when we take, you know that we believe in this because we hold this, you know, as the Jewish community, we hold this history so closely, well, then we have to care about these other things that are happening now that may not directly apply to us, but the theme is still there. That was a big decision for me to embark on this project.
Most definitely the theme is there, especially in what's going on in today's world. And as you said, if we don't share the stories and keep the stories alive, the memories alive, it's going to happen again and again and again, and everyone's going to feel isolated and think that, well, this only happened to me, it could never happen again, which we know that history has, you know, unfortunately, history has a history of repeating itself in so many ways. I know that one of the things that got you started, other than a professor, Avram Katz, who during Yom HaShoah, which is the Holocaust Remembrance Day, asked you to do something, and it was the day before it was the day before the Remembrance Day, but you said the following year you would. Eli Wiesel, who was a Holocaust survivor, one of the things that one of his friends who survived with him said, I had never imagined that one day someone would have the power just by looking at me to decide whether I would live or die. And I believe that got you started on something called selection. Tell us how do you see dance? I know you don't do it literally. You don't take the words and literally, you know, go out there and say them. You do an interpretation. So how do you see that as, how do you even come up with the choreography for something like that?
Yeah, so that quote is from a Holocaust survivor, Agi Geva. And to create selection, I had taken different memories from my research of a couple of different survivors' memories on the selection process in the ghettos and in Nazi concentration camps. That was a quote that had really stuck out to me. And just by the point of a finger of which direction someone was pointing in would decide whether or not she would live or die and stay with her mother and her sister at the time. And, you know, I go through a lot of this research and a lot of these testimonies, and I always start simply by taking, you know, the images and the memories that jump out at me, that when I'm reading them, I have kind of a visceral reaction and it resonates with me and it sticks with me. And that was one of those moments. I believe there's a very powerful universal language to movement and dance. We sometimes don't even realize it, but there's even a psychological component of how certain movements communicate to us and they communicate across languages. So it started some of the movement in that with simply like a point of a finger and then choosing that direction. And then that momentum and the weight that that gesture and movement has could take the dancers into places. So I often will, when developing choreography, start from a very small gestural place. What is the initial movement? That is the image coming from that memory. And then as I think more about, okay, what is the context of this memory? What are the emotions behind it? What is the weight that it carries? It helps me develop it further into full body movements, adding direction, adding the rest of the body. If you can point from your finger, can you point from your hips? Can you point from the knees? Can it have that same urgency, fear, and reach associated with it? But most of the movement I create will come from an initial small gesture. Words really help me and ideas. And then I will build it out from there. And I'll use those different layers of, all right, well, here's the small initial thing as it is, the one word, the one gesture. What is the context of it? What is the weight of it? What are the emotions behind it? And I'll let that develop the gesture into what the full movement becomes.
And the dancers that you have are not strictly Jewish people.
Correct. I intentionally work with non-Jewish dancers. And so the first piece that I had created at Elon for our Yom HaShoah programming, there weren't other Jewish dancers in the dance program for me to work with. So I'm not sure so much if it was a conscious decision for the first piece to work with non-Jewish dancers. It was just, you know, I didn't have other Jewish dancers to work with. And I saw it as it was a trio, the first piece I created, Do I Want to Remember at Elon? So I just picked dancers that I knew had strong work ethic, were beautiful dancers, and that would be wonderful to work with on this project that held a lot of significance to me. So we started that piece, and because I was creating it on dancers in the dance program for Yom HaShoah programming, which is more, you know, it's more a religious holiday than like International Holocaust Remembrance Day. So it was a very small program run through Elon's Hillel. But friends of mine from Elon's dance program and non-dance friends as well knew I had been working on this piece, and they came to that programming. And I was remember sitting there wondering, are they comfortable? There's some like prayers involved and Hebrew singing. I'm like, they may feel out of place. They may feel uncomfortable. It's my hope that they would feel comfortable. But I got very positive feedback from the friends who had come to that, from my professors in the dance program as well on that work, from my peers in the dance program, from my non-dance peers who hadn't been in a Yom HaShoah programming before. They felt they could connect. They felt it was meaningful. And they, you know, they thought they enjoyed the dance. And so part of that drive was, this is an opportunity just from presenting that first work to bring Holocaust education outside of the Jewish community, because it is often so concentrated in the Jewish community, but through performing arts that can drive other people in, where it's like, oh, this won't just be prayers in a synagogue. You know, this is a dance thing. This is a performing arts thing. My friends dancing in this, let me go see what they've been working on. Seemed like a really strong opportunity to bring that Holocaust education outside of strictly the Jewish bubble that I had been experiencing it in. So as I kept developing Zahor, I decided I would continue to work with non-Jewish dancers so that they could have that experience learning these histories in doing this work and in learning this movement and performing this movement, sharing these stories. And then ideally, they would be able to share it with their own, their respective communities and friends and families to further bring it outside of the Jewish community.
Now, didn't you go one step further? I think it was, you know, during the pandemic, you did a lot over Zoom. And in some ways, that kind of helped bring it even further along with the dancers being able to interpret for themselves. Because one of the people that the dance Hidden, that program, it's based on Aaron Elster, who was a survivor, a Holocaust survivor, and he was hidden, saved by being hidden by a non-Jewish family during the Holocaust. And he wrote a memoir. Tell us how you educated or had your dancers self-educate themselves on this particular story.
Yeah.
So create the dance.
Yeah. So prior to the pandemic, it really was like me doing this research by myself, me generating the movement by myself, and then teaching it to the dancers. For the first piece we were doing, when it was first set when I was in college, you know, we're busy students among hustle and bustle of all the other things. The rehearsals were a quicker process. And then I had the opportunity to present it in Boston. And our rehearsals, again, setting it on three Boston-based dancers this time, was also a quicker process, where I just went in and taught the movement as it was derived from my research and my understanding. And then the pandemic hit. We had plans to be developing that initial piece further into a full collection, an evening length collection of works with different stories. And then, you know, we all know how 2022 goes. It changed everyone's plans. As an artist, and for many of my other friends who are artists, a lot of our work is not what is considered the top significant, or what do they call it? Essential. You know, it's not part of the essential workers. Most of our hours were cut in half, at best, I should say. Some of us just lost all of our work completely, which is a huge hit to take. And it also leaves you with like, you're not doing so much. So I talked to my dancers. I was like, I know we don't know what's going to happen. March 2020 was right around the time we were going to pick up rehearsals to keep developing the work. Would you guys want to get together over Zoom and just see how much of it we can develop over Zoom? Something for everyone to do, to be creative together and be working on this. But because we're at home, we're in our own small respective apartments. No one's got huge dancing space for the most part. It started with like, let's have a Zoom and let's just talk. Like, why is this important to me? What has inspired me to do this project? What are your experiences with Holocaust education? And we started just by talking, gaining a sense of where they were. And what they had experienced. You know, it was a brief unit in a history textbook when I was in high school, or we read one novel or one story, which is like, it's very interesting to hear those perspectives too. When I grew up with so much so frequently, you need the historical, you need the numbers, you need to understand the breadth, but you also need multiple individual stories. If you read Survivor Testimonies, just a one-off book, what differentiates that from all the other books that you're reading? It doesn't carry the breadth and the weight, but just like studying the numbers itself doesn't carry the weight. because numbers sometimes go over your head, especially when you're a teenager and you're in high school. But yeah, we started there, and then we started building selection, which I knew, inspired by these memories of the selection process, the dancers were going to be standing in ranks anyways. They were going to be standing in rows. They're not moving their feet. So that we could do from our apartments, right? Just mostly upper body and gestural. But we had this time on Zoom, and we couldn't be developing it in the way we would have in the studio, where we're traveling around each other, we're making formations. So instead, I took the time with the dancers to really explain each of those memories. For example, that memory by Agigeva that you had read, and memories by Elie Wiesel as well, these different images, how the movements, where they were coming from. So I was able to walk them through, like, here's the choreography. It came from this section, came from this memory, and this is how I developed it. I could see that when we ended up, we ultimately filmed it outdoors at the New England Holocaust Memorial in August of 2020 as a short dance film, the piece we had been building over Zoom. And I could see very clearly that the dancers' storytelling, the way that they understood each of the movements they were doing and understood how to communicate them, was so powerful. And they even did it in masks. We were outside filming in masks because August of 2020, that's what we thought you needed to be doing. It's funny to me when I look at pictures from that piece, I'm like, we didn't need to be, but we didn't know then. We were just following the guidance. But even with masks, it doesn't bother me that they're masked in that film. Their bodies are physically telling the story. When you dance, there's like the first layer you learn, even as a kid, to like tell the story through your face. Are you happy? Are you sad? And the facials. And sometimes as you're learning still, like the body is still, could be the same for a happy or a sad dance, any emotion you give it. But they embodied those memories and they communicated the weight of each memory, the urgency, the directionality. I didn't even need to see their faces. They brought it into their bodies, the way they told the story, so powerfully. And from that experience, I decided to create this ongoing series of Zahor. How could I further dive into that embodied Holocaust education experience the dancers involved in selection had, where they were able to really take that story and then powerfully communicate it to an audience? They didn't even have their faces to tell that story to the audience. They physically communicated it with their dancing and storytelling. So I began a research project, which developed into Hidden, of having the dancers do the research with me. I sent them each a copy of Aaron Elster's book in the mail. We started on Zoom still, and had them each read it, had them each pick the memories that jump out at them, that resonated with them, as I had been doing in my research. And we started just by discussing on Zoom, discussing the memories the dancers had picked out, discussing different reflection questions I had gave them. And from there, we went through that process that I had been doing on my own, but I had them doing it with me because I wanted them to have more of that embodied experience. I already know that this history is very important to me to keep alive and keep going, but to give them some of that artistic ownership inside of the work, you know, how can we build a piece that isn't just around the memories that resonate with me, but what about the memories that resonate with them? And why do they resonate with them? What are their lenses in?
That's it. Were you surprised by some of the memories that they chose and what really resonated with them?
It's hard to say surprised, I think, because... Or,
what's another word? Were you... it's not happy. Were you really... impressed by some of the memories that they chose?
I think impressed is a good word. I think something that struck me in taking even the initial conversations on Aaron's book was being able to then not only reflect on it on my own, as I had been doing up till that point with the research I was doing, but to hear their reflections, to hear where they came at it, to hear the empathy that they had for certain character and the different lenses that they brought to it, was really powerful and takes it so much further than it is when it's me on my own, right? It takes a village, you know, that expression. So to have everyone's reflections together, everyone's perspectives together, opens it up to be so much more than it ever could be with just one person and just one person's interpretation. For example, when I first read Erin's book, I had actually ordered the book. I wanted to create a piece and focus on almost the heroicness of those who did hide Jews during the Holocaust. And so I had found his story through a 60 Minutes Dimensions and Testimony through the USC Shoah Foundation. One of my dancers had actually shared it during the process of selection in our like Facebook group, you know, if anyone's interested to look into this. I was like, I do want to hear his story. I'll see how I can learn more of his story. And I found his book, ordered it, and I read it. And I was expecting to like the Gorskys, the family that hid him. I wanted the focus originally to actually be on them and what they had done. And when I first read the book, I couldn't. It was from his perspective as a 10-year-old. And yes, these people took a huge sacrifice to save his life, but they kept him in the attic and they made him feel guilty for being there because they were putting them at such a risk. And that's from his perspective as a 10-year-old. Far later in life, as he goes to tell his story, now Erin would say that his mother gave birth to him, but the Gorskys gave him life. Miss Gorsky gave him life and the chance to live. But of course, as a 10-year-old in that situation, that wasn't how he saw it. So I was surprised when I first read the book. I couldn't like the Gorskys in the way that I wanted to. And the first conversation I had with my dancers, they really empathized with them and thought like, you know, these people are still doing the biggest sacrifice and maybe they needed to distance themselves from him and like to still be able to save him. It got into conversations about families who hide immigrants in America today, even. It was really powerful to see the different lenses they were able to bring and the different perspectives they had on reading it and how much more it opened up than my own reflections alone.
That's fantastic. The work that you do and keeping this alive and doing it in a way that young people get involved is so, it so honors the survivors. And, you know, as time goes on, there are so fewer and fewer survivors alive. And to continue to keep the memory and the history going is huge. It's something we can never forget. So much of this is it's history, but as we said before, sometimes history has a habit of repeating itself. And if we don't know that this has happened before and don't understand it, it's going to just continue to happen. And what you're doing is keeping the stories and the history alive, as one person said, one step at a time. And so I congratulate you for doing it. I think it's so inspiring. Where are you taking this further? I know you've done selection, hidden. What's next on the list of stories?
Well, right now I'm actually premiering a new piece. This new piece that I've been working with is to the music of Erwin Schulhoff, who's a Jewish composer and a Holocaust victim. So it's been a new lens to work by because it's not a survivor's memories. It is the work of a Holocaust victim that survived him. It's taken a different lens. As we've explored his work, Schulhoff was one of many artists to be banned by the Nazis. He was one of the first European musicians to begin to incorporate jazz into classical music forms, and the Nazis hated jazz. They saw it as a threat to their ideology because it is the music of the African-American community. And in Europe at the time, there were so many Jewish jazz musicians practicing. So they believed it to be a conspiracy of the Jewish and Black communities trying to threaten Germany. They had, you know, and they really put that out there. And they had all this propaganda and attempt to turn German people against it. And it goes beyond jazz. They banned and turned people against essentially all modern art. They labeled it Antarktische Musik and Antarktische Kunst, degenerate music and degenerate art. And they convinced the public that this was, you know, this was bad for him. It was bad influence. It's Jewish influences, foreign influences. And as we've done our research and we dissect, so what is it that they were so threatened by that? Essentially anything outside of classicism in art. It's the individual expression and the diverse perspectives, this art form that was giving way for new perspectives to rise in Germany and in Europe, especially with jazz music after World War I, was giving a huge way for immigrants and the Jewish community to gain power and success with this music. So we've been dissecting kind of what it is that, and that in art, that is what makes art art, as far as what makes dance an art form rather than a sport, though people will also consider it a sport, and that's both are perfectly valid. It's the individuality and the expressiveness of it. And that expressiveness and that individuality was such a threat to this regime. So by reviving his work, it sort of denies that regime any posthumous victory that, like, yes, of course, they took his life and they took the life and the careers of many artists who were artistic trailblazers of their time. But we have the ability to revive this work. And to revive it, what we're doing is reviving it in a modern day context. So we have to look at that pressure of conformity for the Nazis, strictly of classicism. Well, where does that exist in ways that we may not even know in our own lives, especially as artists today? I can find it so easily in, I also teach, so I teach ballet and I teach contemporary and classical environments. And I can very easily find where those pressures are that try to weed out the individuality and expressiveness from dance. And from our conversations and as we develop this work, we're trying to find ways, you know, how can we bring that back into it? That's such an important part of it. And we want to be part of reviving this legacy of Schulhoff and his work and of many other artistic trailblazers. So that's the newest work I'm premiering in Zahor. And I'll also be continuing to develop Hidden, which was a dance film, into an evening length work. And I'm going to be bringing even younger dancers into the process as well. So I'll be doing a teen embodied Holocaust education workshop series, an intensive this summer. And those teen participants will get to perform alongside my cast of professional dancers in this live performance.
That's fantastic. I mean, you're just not keeping the stories alive. You're spreading them out throughout generations. And for me, I thank you. And for all the people I know who were affected by the Holocaust, be it their family or themselves, and for those who are still questioning, you know, with all the theories that are out there, what you're doing is huge. Rachel, where can people find more about you and maybe even see some of the work that you've done?
Yeah, so I have most everything up on my website. If you go to rachelinsky.com/Zahor, is it helpful to spell it out for a podcast?
Sure.
Sure. So Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, Linsky, linsky.com/Zahor, Z-A-C-H-O-R. And on my website, I kind of keep it's like my digital portfolio. You can see all of the past works that are on film. There's information about upcoming shows of the Schulhoff piece. There will be information about the premiere of Zahor and the teen workshop series as well. coming soon. The premiere of Hidden will be in October of 2022. And you can also sign up for my mailing list there and stay up to date and get updates on everything going on in different projects in Zahor. I'm hoping once Hidden is developed to tour it to different cities around the country, to different Holocaust museums and education centers, and then to do that teen workshop series with local teenagers in each city and incorporate that local community into the performance and into the sharing of this story. That will be for next year, for 2023 goals.
Well, Rachel, I thank you for sharing this information, for doing what you're doing. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, Sylvia.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.